Good afternoon from New York. My name is Rekha Rangachari, and I'm the Executive Director of the New York International Arbitration Center, or NIAC. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the first iteration of the NIAC podcast series. Today, we're sitting down with arbitral institutions to discuss their ingenuity during the COVID-19 pandemic, focusing on adjusting to the new normal as business shifts online. I'm delighted to be joined by an all-star lineup of leaders in arbitration, known to many of you. Therefore, allow me a very brief introduction of each presenter. Merit Krasula is counsel at the International Chamber of Commerce, ICC, Court of Arbitration's Outpost in New York, CICANA. Luis Martinez is vice president of the International Center for Dispute Resolution, ICDR, the international arm of the American Arbitration Association, AAA. Helena Tavares Erickson is Senior Vice President of Dispute Resolution Services and Corporate Secretary of the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. And Matthew York is General Manager of JAMS, covering Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. In my email of yesterday, I shared the institutional resource pages with a dearth of options and invite you to visit there as your questions and curiosities arise. These include CPR's COVID-19 Resource Center, the AAA ICDR's COVID-19 Update, ICC CICANA's COVID-19 Messages, and JAMS Coronavirus Resource. In addition, I make note of a few resources also available on the web that may be of interest. NIAC Founding Firms COVID-19 Updates, the American Bar Association Society of International Law Arbitration Subcommittee's COVID-19 Quick Reference Guide, KSAB International's SOL Protocol on Video Conferencing in International Arbitration, and CIARB's Guidance Note on Remote Dispute Resolution Proceedings. The format of this podcast will be that each speaker provides an overview of its institutional response. We'll have all audience questions saved until the end of these presentations, but I invite you, as questions arise, to use the Zoom portal to submit your questions therein. As needed, you can also submit questions to NIAC's email, info@niac.org. We've earmarked for a soft stop at 12:45 p.m., but where questions arise and discussion is robust, we'll go until 1 o'clock p.m. With that, I'd now like to cede the floor to Merit Krasula. Merit?
Oh, hi, Rekha. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today. And thank you again to Rekha for her leadership in setting up this program today. I think it's important that we, through this program, reassure the business community and the arbitral community that even in times of crisis, arbitral institutions are continuing to provide essential services that allow parties to resolve their disputes. So it's nice to see hear all of your voices on the call. But I think given all the developments around the world, I think it's also an opportunity for arbitration to grow in light of its flexibility. As many of you know, national courts have had to limit their operations, but arbitral institutions have remained open and really taken measures to allow disputes to move forward. And I think we should all be proud of that. So today I just want to give you a quick overview of what has been going on the ICC side of things, and to mention that our global case management operation is fully functional, that there really has been limited in interruption. All the offices of the Secretariat in Hong Kong, Sao Paulo, Singapore, New York, Paris are operational. All staff members are healthy. We're all working from home in New York and elsewhere. So far, so good. In terms of cases, in terms of court sessions, none of them have been canceled. There really hasn't been any interruption in terms of scrutiny of awards or in terms of any administrative decisions being taken. I actually just got off a video call a few minutes ago from this morning's ICC court session. So everything went quite seamlessly. Just to give you a war story, this crisis has not stopped people from filing emergency arbitrator applications. We actually had one filed about 2 weeks ago, and it was resolved within the usual 15-day time limit to the party's satisfaction. Some of you might remember about 2 weeks ago, there was an email that was sent out to users, arbitrators, counsel involved in ICC cases where we were requesting requests for arbitration and applications for emergency arbitrators to be filed by email. That was already the case in most cases already. But in some instances, we still had to notify hard copies. But I think there is a bit of a small revolution here happening where more and more parties are feeling more comfortable that we proceed entirely on the basis of emails going forward. We also see a lot of tribunals using the flexibilities that already existed under the ICC note with respect to signing awards and electronically, notifying those awards electronically to the party, which kind of the tribunal having to circulate signature pages across the world and many people touching it and having to go to their local courier shop. So I think that is a welcome development on that side. And in any event, sometimes that has been impossible. So another war story I can give you is we even had our Secretary General and Deputy Secretary General in Paris packing FedEx envelopes in Paris for the parties where we absolutely had to notify things via hard copy. So we've definitely shown a lot of flexibility when it comes to getting things done in this crisis. Something I do want to raise also, and you will likely be hearing about this in the next few hours later today, is the release of guidelines for parties and arbitrators how to conduct case management in time of COVID-19. Those will give you kind of a perspective on things to consider when taking certain case management decisions during the course of your arbitration. To give you a general sense of what we're seeing from the Secretariat in terms of the processing of cases, most cases are moving forward, albeit with kind of modified schedules by consent of the parties via Zoom, via Microsoft Teams. You know, at the ICC, we don't really have a virtual platform, so we, for now, leave it to the tribunal and the parties to decide what's appropriate and efficient and secure in the circumstances. In any event, I think that the majority is that the majority situation is that most people are proceeding virtually, and this is, I guess, a recognition of, and I saw Lucy Green's name on the attendees for this call, that a lot can be accomplished without having to get on a plane. And, you know, there are ways to travel less and embrace long distance technology even more, not just so much to reduce our carbon footprint, but also from a sort of cost efficiency and safety perspective too nowadays. And, you know, I mentioned the cases that are being postponed or taking place virtually. We also see a lot of cases that are being settled, suspended, or withdrawn altogether, subject to being refiled in the future once this crisis is over. One point of contention that we've seen also is some disagreements have arisen over whether arbitrators can or should order, let's say, a virtual hearing despite an objection of the party that it should proceed in person only. So we have a few tribunals having to grapple with that issue, and our guidance note that will be released will give you a sense of, will give you some recommendations as to how to approach that issue. And I'll close finally on one thing, and I think my colleagues from other institutions will mention the same thing. In terms of programming, our ICC Academy is actually hosting a program on force majeure that is taking place tomorrow. So for those that are interested, feel free to tune in. But also for the arbitrators and counsel on this call, the ICC Institute is actually also working on pandemic-specific programming that is in relation to interim measures, practical considerations for arbitrators and counsel, how to handle a hearing remotely in an efficient way, how to take advantage of your tribunal secretary, how to ensure good oral advocacy at a remote hearing, Is it a good time to settle your case? So issues like that, that we hope will be useful for counsel and arbitrators as we deal with these matters for the foreseeable future. Thanks, Rika.
Great. Thank you so much. Well, I have a question to posit to you. I'm cognizant of the time, but a recent ICC hearing venued at NIAC transitioned and quite successfully to an online mode in its second week in light of the shelter-in-place order in New York. And I know that there are other ICC matters, as you've mentioned yourself, even larger ones, even than the one that was with us, that have transitioned online. And so I'm curious, any feedback from counsel and the tribunal in terms of moving to that modality?
All I know for now is that, the hearing did take place. I won't get into the confidential details that I can't, but I know it was a hearing that took about 5 days. I know at some point there were over 30 participants from many cities across two continents. And at least the feedback that I've received was that things went well. There was some hot tubbing of expert witnesses and everything seems to have was completed on a timely basis without much, without many difficulties. I'm not sure to what extent everyone perhaps shares that impression simply because I haven't heard from many people. But I think it was helpful that the tribunal and the parties had agreed on a sort of a protocol at the inception of the hearing to kind of decide how things should proceed virtually. And I think that helped them organize the proceeding. And in relation to that question, Rika, I also think that I know that there are some people out there working on guidelines, model guidelines for virtual arbitration hearings, i.e. how to select, your virtual platform, how to prepare yourself for it and your witnesses, how to test it, how do you integrate, interpreters in such a hearing. So hopefully we can hear more about it and from them about that, those initiatives, recommendations, and protocols in the next few weeks.
Thanks so much, Merrick. Yes, and stay tuned. I've heard that drafts, not only of protocols, but also of articles, are circulating. And so we hope to be able to provide you those when they become public. And I echo from what I've heard as well that the case went seamlessly. So cheers to the resilience of the IA community and the ability of us to adapt. Luis, I turn next to you and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Rika. And let me also thank you for setting this up. That's greatly appreciated. I still cannot believe that we're living through this incredible moment in our history. And really, my thoughts are with those that have been affected or are struggling with this pandemic. It's truly incredible. I start by reminding myself of a quote, "Uncertainty is the only certainty there is." And it's really a truism, and it really emphasizes the importance of trying to be prepared for the unexpected. And while the world has seen pandemics before this one, where we can be on the other side of the planet in 24 hours and this incredible global economic impact, it's really going to challenge any corporation's business continuity plan. And from our perspective, we did benefit from some of the hard-learned lessons from past tragedies, such as 9/11 and Hurricane Sandy. And I'm sure we're going to learn from this one. But the business continuity plan we had in place has really been helpful to keep us fully operational. Now, some of the key points that plan covered was to consider loss of offices and loss of access to our cases and data. The AAA ICDR has extensive backup and protected servers for the protection of its data, so that wasn't a big problem. In this case, the main challenge has been repositioning our case counsel to work from home. Now, the VPs and executives and select other employees already had that capability, but with the closing of now our 28 offices, including many with hearing rooms, while having to manage thousands of cases, postponing and rescheduling hundreds of hearings, the first task was really to expand our telework capabilities. And that was the top priority, while ensuring that our commitment to cybersecurity, confidentiality, and data privacy was maintained. So our staff, what we did, received AAA ICDR encrypted laptops using VPN and secure phone apps with double password authentication. For example, right now, the entire international team is working remotely, and we have team status calls on a daily basis, including some calls with our staff in Singapore. Actually, if there's any benefit at all to this crisis, is that I'm really seeing my colleagues more now than I have in quite some time. So the fact of the matter is that our administrative arbitration and mediation services have been transitioning to a paperless system for some time now, which has been a huge help to us during this crisis. Our electronic case management platforms are connected and allow for seamless remote administration. So for example, I log into our system and I have access to all of my cases. I start the day off by calling my director in Miami and we discuss our next steps. The most immediate cases that require attention are highlighted daily for me in red, which for yesterday, as an example, it required the appointment of an emergency arbitrator. We discuss potential candidates, considering the party's requested qualifications. We reach out to the potential candidates for some initial screening. We prepare the documents, and they are generated and sent out from our platform. Now, at the same time, the users have access to all of their AAA ICDR case info and documents through our web file platform, and that's linked to the internal administrative platform that we have. So they can access their cases in real time that will reflect what we've done, the status of the case, all relevant notifications and financials, for example. Then the other part of it is that the AAA arbitrators have their own platform with their info that if they're on a case is linked to the other two platforms, again, they're able to see their documents and case-related info. So the result is you really have a fully electronic, remotely administered system. By and large, though, we don't have really impediments to our ability to administer our cases remotely. I would say the biggest challenge obviously concerns the in-person hearings. And with our offices closed, we've been offering the parties the possibility of using Zoom or other platforms for those hearings. Our legal department now is in the process of finalizing our protocol for video conferencing. And we've also set up an internal team that's been testing the options and coordinating the settings for these video conferences. We've discussed various model orders that a tribunal can draft in advance of these sessions. And we have prepared a checklist highlighting, for example, amongst other things, that you know, the need to conduct test calls, camera positioning, Wi-Fi capabilities, the need to avoid virtual backgrounds, at least for witnesses, and that putting them on notice that at any moment the tribunal could ask them to pan their camera around from their witness location to perhaps minimize the possibility of coaching. How to use the breakout rooms, communications within those rooms and the waiting rooms. So there are a number of factors, as we all know, that we have to consider. But I'll say this, that to date, I would say the trend is rather to postpone the hearings. While, you know, we have the capabilities, I'm seeing parties opt out, not opting into it. They're deciding to postpone or reschedule and still wanting to keep the in-person hearing option. So far, that's the main trend. Now, as you saw in the materials, you can fully read about the COVID response on our website, www.adr.org, and also about the ability of all the things you can do in filing online web file. Another important thing I'd like to mention is that our leadership recognizes the stress and concern that our employees throughout the country are going through, as is everyone. Our president, India Johnson, conducts weekly calls with our entire staff, providing updates on how the organization is doing, her perspectives regarding the crisis. And she does mention a number of COVID-related resources that the staff can access. We have our own internal InfraSight. And, you know, I think that really helps in this time with so many workers working remotely. It really reminds them that they're not alone and that many of us are sharing the same fears, concerns, and stress. So they're very helpful. And lastly, from an international perspective, I can share that I had a call with our international Y&I network with members of their executive board, and that by and large, these firms from positioned in different countries said they are shut down globally. But they were reporting some openings occurring in China. So maybe to close, I can paraphrase Mr. Churchill that this is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. So we can only hope. And Rake, I'll give it back to you.
Great. Thanks so much, Luis. And a question, you know, Merrick said in general, they're seeing an uptick in be it emergency proceedings or otherwise. What is the state of play at AAA and the market? Are e-filings on the rise? How are things going?
You know, at the moment, and I checked with our intake department, and while there is this capability to do so much online, we've actually seen an 8.6% dip in new demands for arbitration since the COVID-19 impact in the United States. But the decline we're seeing is from fewer labor and employment demand. And I have to think, as they do as well, that these statistics coincide with the period of transition that many law firms and companies were switching to work remotely. And obviously, they were focused at other problems at hand. So that's all we're seeing right now at this early stage. We're tracking it and seeing how this will develop.
Thanks so much, Luis. And I think we can be assured that in a post-COVID world, once we come out of it, arguably there will be an uptick in disputes overall. I now yield the floor to Helena. Helena, welcome.
Thank you, Rekha, and thank you to NIAC for organizing this. Let me start by saying something that one of our clients said to me yesterday. And that is, it is, in his view, amazing how the ADR community, a quote-unquote non-essential business, has adapted and gone forth in this crisis where the courts and other essential businesses are shutting down. From the perspective of CPR, the dispute resolution team always had remote access because of the fact that we travel so much. So the transition to remote was seamless. The only differences for us is that at the moment we are not accepting hard copy filings because, like everyone else, we can't go to our offices. Similarly, we are not accepting checks. We're requiring electronic payments, again, because we cannot go to our offices. We have focused, as befits our structure as both an ADR service provider and a think tank, on helping the community at this time. So we have, as do all the others, a COVID resource page on our website that people can access at cpradr.org. We have also put together a dispute prevention panel of facilitators who can work with parties where there is a potential dispute brewing, force majeure, whatever it may be, to try to come to a resolution before it matures into an arbitration or other legal proceeding. We don't have hearing rooms, at least on a regular basis, so we are focusing on helping our neutrals by providing information about the various platforms and trainings on the various platforms. As many of you may be aware, we have done one training already on Zoom. And, you know, of course, there are risks and warnings with respect to the use of the platform, and we have materials online that go to towards those issues for people who are intending on continuing to use those platforms. We have been blessed with a draft from one of our board members, Richard Ziegler, on virtual arbitration guidelines. And we have put together a task force and will be proceeding in the next couple of weeks to promulgate those for the community at large. For anyone who is using outside platforms, we do suggest that they look at the CPR ICA, New York City Bar Cybersecurity Protocol, and use that as a guideline for cybersecurity issues in the context of virtual hearings. That said, the bottom line for CPR is pretty much business as usual, and I look forward to continuing to work on many cases. Our caseload actually tripled over the last 2 weeks, and we are actually seeing an uptick in employment requests, which I had not anticipated, but so be it. I guess that's it for me. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Helena. And a note, we have a handful of those from the cybersecurity protocol that helped draft that on the line as well, and I'm grateful. But I think that's very important reference that Helena made to that protocol. As well, I wanted to raise a question about the draft procedural order that CPR in discussions now with their arbitration committee, but will be putting out at some point. Helena, can you share any key concerns during sort of the drafting of that that may be pertinent to our audience today?
Well, I'm not sure that the version that we will be offering will in fact be in the form of a draft procedural order. It may not. We're still in discussions about that. The main focuses or foci of the guideline/procedural order will be what to do in terms of recommendations for platforms. And I think we're likely to come out that is something that has to be worked out between the parties and the panel in any particular arbitration, because needs are different. Accessibility may be different. What may be acceptable for two sophisticated law firms and three sophisticated arbitrators may be very different for a pro se employee and a sole arbitrator and an employer on the other side. So we'll be looking at all of those issues. We'll also be looking at, obviously, the cybersecurity issues. And really, we're looking forward. We're soliciting and have solicited comments from the community as a whole, and we're looking forward to reviewing those and coming out with something, as I said, in the next 2 weeks.
Fantastic. Well, so everyone, stay tuned. I think there's going to be a dearth of even more resources that we can all turn to as we weather the storm. With that, I'd like to turn to Matt. Matt, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Rekha. It's and thank you to my colleagues who spent the time today to prepare for this, and for everybody for spending the time to join us here on this podcast live or listen later. It is remarkable, and you know, while there's many challenges that have developed over the last few weeks for many of us on the professional and personal side, often in these situations, opportunities arise. And so there have been a number of opportunities that we have taken over the last few weeks over at JAMS. And one of them in particular that I think I'll start with is just sort of an opportunity to stop and think a little bit more about sort of service and how we are providing our service. And, you know, part of our aim and our goal at JAMS is to make sure that we are a service provider that is providing the highest level, as well as I know the folks at ICC and CPR and AAA and ICDR do as well every day. We want to make sure we're on par with that. And so this has given us an opportunity to sort of step back amidst the chaos of trying to change over our business, but to step back and think about that. And so in these times, it's actually helped us a great deal to refocus on perspective and priority about how we're going to do this and what we're doing and how we're delivering. Proud to say it started at the top with our leadership, our CEO, Chris Poole, and our COO, Kim Taylor, and the entire senior management team. Sprung into action immediately as we started getting closer, and I know the other providers will share this similar experience, as we started to think about the fact that, okay, we need to make some changes now. We need to do them rather quickly. As you know, Luis had stated, and I don't want to restate, we had a lot of similar experiences probably to his organization in taking our entire workforce remote, as well as also figuring out how to best support our panel and our clients remotely. Luckily, we did have contingency plans in place already that we were able to sort of refine, although I will tell you that, you know, in trying to be quite candid, it seemed to be, as we started talking about this probably in February, every day or two, we would have to change that contingency plan because the landscape seemed to change. And then as we got closer to the middle of March, it was evident that every few hours we were changing that contingency plan. And I'm sure there's a lot of people nodding right now, too, because it seems like we have not stopped that. And I know law firms are dealing with the same thing, businesses, and even just at home with our own families. Everything just keeps changing. But as I said, from that becomes the opportunity. And so our senior management team was able to lay out a great plan for us that has been executed. And probably the best part about this is being able to see the resiliency of our staff. So since that time, our staff has shifted completely from the close to 30 locations that we have all remote. And our panel has done the same. And we have shifted our entire caseload to virtual sessions. And so on the mediation and arbitration side, initially in March, we saw a dip, and now we're starting to see that over the last few weeks return, and it's returning in spades. And as clients and businesses are starting to think about, okay, what's next? And in an uncertain future, how are we going to get back to work? They are choosing virtual options. And so I share my colleagues over at CPR and AAA and ICC who are saying that, you know, as unusual as this is, we seem to be getting back to business as usual. So it has been a very unique time for us as we tried to figure out how to roll this out and implement this the best way. We are using virtual platforms, as I mentioned, various different platforms, including our own proprietary platform called Indispute. But as well, we are using Zoom and other platforms. But it's basically driven by what the client requests to use in that moment in time. So moving forward, it has been rather unique to see how the market is sort of using these processes and procedures, including the use of electronic signatures, electronic document systems. And it's unique to see how folks have sort of been forced into being comfortable with that. And so I think we're starting to see sort of the folks saying, wait, let's slow down a little bit. Let's think about this a little bit more. And in an arbitration setting, I'll share sort of the earlier sentiments that we are seeing folks very carefully and thoughtfully try to decide what the best option for their arbitration is going to be. So speaking about whether or not we should go forward now, whether or not we should delay or reschedule, we are seeing arbitrations go forward and we're seeing initially a lot of them rescheduled to down the line. However, as the landscape continues to change, we're seeing folks start to come back presently and say, well, let's explore the virtual options. So our case management team's helping everybody proceed forward and try to help to implement that and make sure that we are doing this in the best way possible. As with the other providers, we provide online resources and as well on our website at jamsadr.com. And we are trying to help the parties just get back to business. So as well, our staff has been working very hard to continue to be a resource in sort of the mindset of being of service by providing a CLE and webinar options for training, whether it be training on virtual platforms or else even just discussing about what's going to be best for your case. Is it best to think about rescheduling and waiting long term? Or is it best to try a virtual option now? And if you are, how do we do that? And what is the best platform for you? So our case managers are working actively and talking to clients consistently, and as well serving our panel to try to make sure that they have what they need and they're trained to be able to handle these matters virtually. So it's been an interesting time for all of us, but I'm very pleased that to hear the other organizations as well doing so good at this time.
Thanks so much, Matt. So a question for you, you know, on JAMS as well as the other institutions, so many things there within their COVID-19 resource centers. For JAMS in particular, End Dispute, which everyone on the phone may not be aware of, this bespoke online dispute resolution platform. And so my query to you is, what are key functionalities that sort of necessitated a build out of a bespoke system? And what does that look like?
So it's really up to the clients about what their preference is. And so End Dispute itself is a four-fee system. And so what it does is it's powered by Court Call, which we're all very familiar with. And so it will come with professional moderator breakout rooms, as well as isolated caucus if it's necessary. Many of the features that the other video conference services provide. However, it will be a bit more dedicated so that there is a concentration on that security and as well making sure that the parties are able to tailor the process however they see fit. To that end, we see, and this is by and large, we see many of the parties over the past few weeks elect to use the Zoom option, as most of the other providers have mentioned as well, because of the fact that it was free. However, we've seen in the last few days, there has been some pushback on that, and the concerns that Helena had illustrated earlier are ones that we're helping our clients work through presently as well.
And just to be clear, to add to that, to the extent that CPR has done training, it is on Zoom Professional. We do not believe that the free version is at the level that is required for any ADR proceeding.
And I think that's an important distinction, the different sort of options one can purchase after the free profile really allow for greater security. And I think actually if we stick with this, because there has been a write-in question as well, and something that I think many of us are curious about. Zoom recently, it seems to be sort of the earmarked and preferred provider by various groups. There are other groups out there, Microsoft Teams, BlueJeans, GoToMeetings, and I'm sure several others that you all could think of. But Zoom, I think, has taken the preferred route. In parallel, however, you may know Zoom is being sued in a class action suit by one of its shareholders for overstating its privacy standards and failing to disclose that its service was not end-to-end encrypted. And it's trying to respond to that. One aspect of that response is to ensure that each meeting has a secure password tethered to that meeting. And so that hackers can't get in, as well as a monitoring of those that are entering the virtual meeting. And having the ready ability to kick out those who may be disruptors to a meeting. Those are just some of the security protocols in place with Zoom. But if we stick to that, the question comes in regarding Zoom. And here it is. Regarding Zoom, what are steps arbitral institutions are taking regarding privacy and security issues with Zoom? Noting the ongoing litigation, as well as a scathing New York Times article that came out. And so I'll throw that question open in a larger sense to everyone to sort of respond on that to our speakers.
I'll just jump in on that one. We are offering Zoom as an option, but we do have a disclaimer because obviously we don't know the sub-issues. We're aware of the litigation, but it's an option and it'll be up to the parties to decide the suitability and whether they'd like to opt in or opt out of it. We are careful about the settings that we're going to have if you're using our Zoom platform in terms of our licenses. I do agree that a professional one is needed, but the settings, whether you control the recording, is there a court reported? Do you send it to the cloud? Do you download it to your computer? We obviously wouldn't publish the Zoom invitation. A password would be required. We would send people into the waiting room first so the host can actually check to see who's in there, and there are no unauthorized users. If we kick someone out, we make the setting clearly state that they can't opt back into it. So to the extent possible, and we actually have what's called a Zoom Champions group of about 20 or so of us that have been just in virtual testing mode, to the extent that we can, without knowing the underlying technology, is try to recommend the proper settings. But it'll be up to the parties, and they'll have to check and be comfortable enough to decide to opt in or opt out and be responsible for the security of its usage.
I'll agree with what Luis said. I mean, we over at JAMS, we're doing something similar, with the password-protected meetings, with locked meetings, with planning ahead for backup systems and options, as well as sort of trying to be creative about the hybrid so that if there are certain elements of the conversation that need to be had, maybe some of the session, whether it be an arbitration or mediation, is held on Zoom and some are used in another forum. But also, the use of the technology in the waiting rooms, but then how the technology is being handled. And again, it's up to the parties for what their comfort level is. And we're not sort of pressing this upon anybody, but most of this is generated by the parties coming to the providers saying, we would like X, Y, or Z. And so then we kind of give them the menu of the options. I don't think anybody would say that there is a perfect option out there right now, but in this time, there isn't going to be a perfect option. So we just have to figure out how best to assist that. One of the ways in a mediation setting and in arbitration, but particularly we've been using it in a mediation setting at JAMS, is that even in a Zoom platform, we are providing our case management team to actually assist and be the host throughout the duration of the session. So they will monitor to make sure that everything is going accordingly and to make sure that there's no one else jumping in that shouldn't be in or whatever it might be to sort of help make sure that we are on top of that and monitoring the Zoom itself. But, from that end, Zoom is addressing these things. And so we, along with the other providers, are trying to just keep up to speed and, give the market what they're requesting.
Yeah, and this is Merrick, and I would just also agree with that. I mean, from our perspective, we don't have an online platform that we're offering the parties, but we are definitely raising the issue of security with respect to these platforms. It's something for the parties to seriously consider before opting into one of those tools. But I can tell you internally, when we, for example, host our own ICC court sessions, we don't use Zoom. We do have an internal electronic platform that is secure, that doesn't utilize the Zoom as a platform. So hopefully when the guidelines come out, this will be something also that the parties will need to factor in when making a final decision when they choose to proceed virtually.
And there came in a write-in question of the cost factor, regardless of the platform chosen. Are the institutions helping to defray costs therewith, or is it really up to the stakeholders part of that case to address costs on their own for the selected modality?
So from CPR's perspective, that
that would be please up to the parties.
Okay, that was Helena. CPR, it's really up to the parties. I think I heard Matt and then Luis.
I would agree with Helena. It is up to the parties. The platform, you know, using Zoom Pro is something that I think most of the providers, if we are using that, you know, we do have Zoom Pro accounts that we can use for, you know, the mediations or arbitrations if they choose to as well. Although we're also seeing, you know, many of the firms and businesses who have their own platforms or, you know, codes and passcodes come to us and say, hey, you know, we'd like to use this one. Is this okay? And then we'll adjust and make sure that we take care of that. And that includes, and I think some of the other providers said that before as well, is going through some test runs with the parties, which I think I've heard that, you know, most providers are doing that. And I know we're doing that at JAMS if it's requested to make sure that everybody's comfortable with the technology, number one. And number two, we also feel as if it will work for that case. And there are plenty of cases where we may get into it, do a walkthrough or run through, and then people say, you know, I don't think this is going to work. And then we adjust and try to figure out what will, up and into including rescheduling the matter until a later date.
And Luis, I know you had a comment, and maybe you can also answer, and I can throw it back to Matt too, to the degree an institution has a Zoom Pro account and they're helping to facilitate, is the institution there with in using their credentials, taking on sort of the cost of using that platform? Or is it later getting passed on? And that might be a TBD answer.
No, by and large, so far, you know, we have quite a few number of pro licenses, and we can alternate them about key staff to be the host for a call. And typically, if they use the computer access to it and the computer audio or local phone numbers, there shouldn't really be a charge. I think the charges really only start to kick in on the pro license if you have more than 300 people or using long distance numbers. So, and we would start the call typically as the host. And then once the arbitrator takes over, provided that we've had some testing and they're comfortable enough with the system, we'll make them co-host so they could operate a lot of the necessary steps moving around within the Zoom hearing itself. So the costs so far seem to be negligible, but maybe I'm missing something. As I said, we haven't had too many of these, so we'll have to see. But whatever costs are, they would be passed on to the parties if we need to pass that on.
Okay, so to be determined on that, I think overall as more use is made. So do stay tuned. In quick summation, just to bring sort of the Zoom queries and what are protocols where there are worries about security and confidentiality. You will be seeing more protocols come into play, as we've already mentioned. As a quick reference guide, the SOL protocol or CIARB's guidance note on remote dispute resolution, those are readily available in addition to what the institutions have provided. So do give those a look. And then there's also a questions coming in actually about authentication signatures on award. So in the first instance, for an e-signature, is the e-signature deemed valid alone, or are you seeing that people are signing and scanning those documents or PDFing them over to the institution? What is deemed appropriate and authenticated fully?
Yeah, hi, Rick, I can answer that question. We're seeing it more often here at the ICC. I mean, that flexibility already existed in the ICC note before, you know, COVID. I'm seeing that more often. I'm seeing the tribunals writing to the parties and asking whether they're okay with electronic notification only. Therefore, the parties would not be receiving a hard copy original. All they would get would be a scanned version of the award with a scanned version of the signature pages. Now, whether the signature pages are, you know, a JPEG image that you copy paste, or whether they're scanned, you know, ink signature, that's another question that the tribunal and the parties have to consider. And I think it's always dependent on what the seat of arbitration is. It's also dependent on what might be the place of enforcement. We don't want to be in a situation where, because the award is not ink signed, under the New York Convention, there is no award. There is an issue with its validity in that jurisdiction. So That's something the parties and the tribunal need to seriously consider. And the ICC note does make reference to what we call, in that note, any mandatory laws that may be applicable in the circumstances to really consider those issues. For now, for cases that have been seated in the U.S. that mostly involve U.S. parties, what I've seen is parties being very flexible there and actually agreeing to that agreement being reflected in the actual award, that the award be notified only by email and signed electronically without actually having a physical signature circulated by mail and then scanned.
Thanks. Any others to weigh in on that, speakers?
I would say, as usual, Merrick hit it right on the head and really explained that nicely. And we're seeing, the similar. And at the end of the day, it is up to the tribunal. The only thing I could add to that is that we are also seeing parties seem to push towards electronic means. So whether it be a product like DocuSign or something similar, there is an increased interest in using those technologies. And there seems to be a comfort in using that as well.
And then later on, too, we sometimes receive requests for certifications and confirmations of the award and the file. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see an uptick later on based on these electronic signatures at this stage during this time period.
Right. Well, so I think the point being, electronic modalities were already in play. It's really a case-by-case basis on what is needed depending on the jurisdiction of enforcement. And so these leaders that are here on the phone are one line of resource for you all should you have questions about a particular case and you're concerned about enforcement or otherwise. So do be in touch because they each have developed their own responses and can work with you, knowing different global jurisdictions based on their own stakeholders. Okay, with that, I wanted to also, there's a comment that came in about a reminder, Joe, thank you, a reminder that we don't all have to move to a virtual platform. And so teleconferences are still available and en vogue. So consider also using that. And so I share that with you. I wanted to give the floor just for a moment to Merrick, because I know to make the point about the case management outline that he had referenced during his presentation and sort of that it will be forthcoming. And Merez, I know you're on the line as well. Apologies. As a security precaution, all delegates are muted without the ability to respond. So instead, if I can shift that to Merrick to provide a comment.
Of course. And I know Merez has been involved in this process, so I'm sure she wanted to add something to that discussion. But my understanding is that something will be released later today. And if Merez, I'm not sure she can intervene in the court. But my understanding is that something should be released later today. And if any of you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us about the guidance notes. We're all remotely and available and happy to discuss any questions you might have.
Merez is writing in. So let me share in adding to Merrick's comment. The ICC note is now available on the website and provides useful guidance. You'll see this comment to all participants, but just to edify you, including a checklist and a draft procedural order. One point to clarify, users, we are available to hear about what the needs are for virtual hearings and the like, and to provide services therewith. And so I think really with that, if you'd look in, if you can, to Merez's comment, it's really a bespoke reality. There are lots of MOUs between centers, hearing centers and the like, to make sure that if you move to an online platform, it has the tenor of what it would if you were in an in-person hearing with all of the bells and whistles, so to speak. And so really, we put it on the clients to ask the questions for what they need for the institutions to be able to help design what's best in that process. Okay, I'm just checking in for the various comments, also cognizant of our time. And so with that, and let me make a note too, after this podcast, we'll be following up with you with additional resources. As we noted, the ICC note is already online. CPR's, whichever form it will take, though, that guiding document will also be available forthcoming, and we'll make sure to be sending it out to you in addition to their own sharing of it. And so we hope that we remain NIAC a resource to you in these times. And so as a final sound off, I wanted to turn back to our speakers and ask this general question. And we'll go, just to make it easy, in the order of their presentations. Will the new normal permeate post-COVID with proceedings and especially hearings moving fully to an online platform? So the order, Marek, Luis, Helena, Matt, please. I'm curious.
Yes and no. I think we're seeing a bit of everything. I think there are some cases that the parties absolutely want the hearing to happen in person and are happy to postpone it later in the future and have it conducted that way. Other cases won't require that. I think maybe parties will discover efficiencies in doing things virtually only that they initially didn't realize would be possible. So I think it'll be a mixed, depending on the type of case that you have and the issues and the number of witnesses that might be involved or experts that might be involved. So we'll see, but I think time will tell, and hopefully we hopefully this doesn't go on for too long, and we're back to the old normal, and these questions don't need to be grappled with for too long.
Yeah, I would agree. I would think, though, we will see somewhat of an uptick in the use of the video conferences and the electronic online platforms. Certainly, as people are exploring and they're being forced to really understand the technology and become comfortable with it, including many of the arbitrators. So with the parties and the arbitrators being more comfortable, it would only stand to reason that we would see that bit of an uptick. But still, the international arbitration complexities, the importance of in-person hearings, witness cross-examination, understanding the body language and the veracity issues, I think there'll always be a need for these in-person hearings, especially in the larger cases that we do see in international arbitration today.
I would agree with Luis, although I think that there will also be some pressure from clients as they see that they can accomplish certain aspects of their hearings, perhaps, oral arguments, post-hearing, et cetera, in a more efficient, less costly manner. On an anecdote, CPR has heard from some of our mediators that individual people who are being forced to mediate from their homes are actually much more comfortable with the process because they are at home and, not in a sterile hearing room or conference room. So that's an interesting observation going forward.
And I would add that I believe, as with anything, we sort of rush to one point and then we sort of back off it and regress a little bit. I think we'll experience some of that in that, we have rushed to this and then we'll probably back off it a little bit. But in an arbitration setting, I think the technology will improve and this will force that. And once it does, I think you'll see parties start to choose certain parts of the arbitration process, as Luis had noted, to use technology more. However, with that said, I think in a mediation setting, as Helena had also mentioned, I think actually this will force the use of technology more often in mediation. And I think we're going to see that, mediation change probably much quicker than arbitration will once we sort of get back to a stable ground, whenever that might be.
Thanks so much, Matt. And so what I want to do, cognizant of the time, it's 101. And so allow me first to thank our speakers and also to all of you tuning in. We have folks from all over the globe, which I think is really indicative of this global community. Again, it's been my pleasure to beam in to you all today with our speakers. I'd like to put out a note, stay tuned for NIAC's next podcast program on April 16th at noon. It's a critical analysis of force majeure in an international context. In addition, I understand that there's an ABR webinar also on the 16th that Merez Philippe and Michael McElrath, in addition to others, will be participating in. We're going to add these all to our Friday NIAC events mailer that we're starting to add slowly as programs move to webinar platforms or elect to reschedule into 2021. And so I invite you all as you schedule programs to do share them with NIAC at info@niac.org. Of course, in these unprecedented times, please stay safe, stay healthy, and most importantly, stay sane. Our international arbitration community is resilient and it's very flexible, as we can see. And indeed, we're all in this together. Thanks so much, everyone, and have a good day.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.